And welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus on this Tuesday, March 11th, 1:06 in the afternoon, and temperatures in the 20s out there today. That's kind of a slap in the face after record warmth yesterday, 66 degrees. Unbelievable. I'm Chief Meteorologist Eden Wysocki, along with our Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. Bridget's on the road again. How are you doing today, Bridget?
No, I need a better desk in here. I got to tell you right now, I got stuff scattered around. It looks like a rummage sale in the back seat, and I'm trying to get all my notes for the show laid out in a reasonable fashion. That's not working. So if anybody wants to recommend a pickup to me that just comes with a front seat desk, I don't maybe need a passenger seat anymore. Maybe I just need a desk over there. That'd be super.
That'd be perfect.
Thanks. Yeah, we'll work out perfect.
Oh, man. I'll tell you what. It's at least the weather is decent. You usually carry the bad weather with you when you're traveling, so at least you have some decent weather this week.
That's right. Let's not talk about bad things.
Okay. We'll have to wait till Saturday for that, because we do have some pretty the potential of some bad weather hanging in here as we head into Saturday. But for today, again, it's going to be, a good 30 degrees colder than yesterday. After record warmth yesterday, today we're only going to make it up, only do about 30 today, with clouds increasing throughout the day. And a little upper-level disturbance will be riding overhead this evening. That could trigger off a few snow showers, a dusting at most, if that. That'll move east into Minnesota overnight. We'll drop down to 22 overnight. And then tomorrow, light winds out of the northwest, highs close to 50. I think we'll be in the upper 40s most of the day. And then breezy conditions on Thursday with highs in the low 60s, mid-60s on Friday, with showers and a few thunderstorms possible as we head into Friday evening. Most of the day should be dry, but I think by late afternoon into the evening, we'll see at least scattered showers and a few thunderstorms developing. And then Friday night, we're going to change that over to snow. And some of that snow could be heavy in the valley for late Friday night into the first half of the day on Saturday. Saturday morning has the potential for blizzard conditions. If not in the valley, it looks like it'll be favoring areas just east of us into Minnesota. It's a tight call. A shift in the storm track just 50 miles, which isn't much. But if this thing shifts east or southeast just by 50 miles, we'll miss out on most of the heavy snow here in the FM area. If it keeps its current track, I think we're going to be in for a headache, would be the nice way to say it, during the day on Saturday. So we'll wait and see how it pans out. It's just moving onshore as we head into late tonight into tomorrow. So we'll get better weather data once it gets onshore, and then we'll see what the track holds. But right now it looks like Saturday. If you have any travel plans on Saturday, might want to alter those, as it could get quite messy around here.
So by Thursday, we're going to remind everybody to get the bread and milk planned for the weekend.
Yeah, right. Yeah, make sure the snowblower starts, all that good stuff, right?
Absolutely. And if you are curious about what things you could be doing over the weekend, well, maybe one of them is looking at auctions. And we're joined today for our On the Auction Block segment with Max Steffes. Max, I hope things are great in your world. You're traveling like I am.
Yeah, you got it. I'm glad our auction calendar includes a lot of online auctions, Bridget, especially through later this week. Sounds like it's going to be a doozy.
How many auctions are you running on a week like this, Max?
You know, this is kind of harvest for us. So in terms of the auction business, you know, busy seasons for us is post-harvest and pre-harvest. And of course, we're in that pre-harvest window, which would be March. And March has historically always been one of the busiest auction seasons, auction months of the year. And for example, this week alone, we have 24 auction events scattered across all over the United States, really. And 11 of those auctions, believe it or not, are today. All of which are online only. So it's a busy week.
Okay. With that, would you say you have a pretty fair split between land auctions or equipment auctions? Is there a time of the year where one is more prevalent than others?
Yeah, certainly in the springtime, in the fall time, so November through December would probably be one of the more busier seasons for land, but it's also very busy for equipment with year end. This time of year, same is true, all the way up until about the 15th of April, where it starts to get a little equipment heavy in terms of our auction calendar. As you talk about June, there's a lot of equipment that trades hands, not typically a lot of farm real estate that trades hands, just because you want to try to sell tillable farm real estate into a market where people can look forward to planting a crop either that year or the following year if you're selling it in the fall of the year.
Well, interesting question. When you talk about land auctions right now, just as we were coming into the show, I heard ABC News talking about some changes as far as tariffs are concerned, with investors in Canada probably being a little skittish that travel is down out of the U.S. into Canada, more talk about tariffs as far as insurance and so forth. When the stock market drops because of that discussion, do you see an uptick in interest in land auctions as more of an investment situation, or does that affect what you're doing whatsoever?
Yeah, it does, Bridget. You know, land is viewed as a stable investment. Land has always been a long-term investment, so you don't buy land for one quarter or one week in hopes of flipping it like you do with a stock or an index fund or something like that. So typically people are looking at land for five at a minimum, 10, 20, 30 generational purchase. So they view it as a stable investment. When the stock market starts to flutter like it is now due to various reasons, a lot of them are probably attributed to the tariff conversation that we're having. We do get some benefit from a bidder interest and a buyer interest with people that maybe somebody has $1 million that's sitting in an index fund and they want to find something that's a little bit more stable. We do see some people reallocate those funds and look at our auction sales in terms of insulation from any future market corrections. We saw that a lot during the COVID years with all the turmoil that went on. There was quite a bit more interest in farm real estate, and that's continued. Land is a wonderful investment, and anybody that owns it knows that.
And Max, you've got a couple of exciting land auctions coming up this week. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, we do. So like we said, really busy season for us, busy week in terms of upcoming auctions. One of the exciting auctions that we have coming up this Thursday, we've got 680 acres selling just north of Flom. It's a contiguous section just north of town there along the highway. It's going to be selling in five tracts, all tillable farmland. One track does have a grain bin on it. Really nice tillable land that's been owned by the Haraldson brothers for, gosh, I think that family's owned it for 50 plus years. So a generational opportunity for somebody to either buy some land to farm this year or to rent it out to somebody that you know and trust.
Speaking of the you know and trust, I saw a tweet the other day and I thought of you right away, Max. And it was a lady saying that her parents have now passed on and she and her sisters were inheriting the farmland. But they were really torn. There are five sisters and three of them want to keep the land. Three want to sell the land. Two want to keep the land. And so they're going to wind up looking for someone to help them sell the farmland off. Do you see those situations happening very often? And I don't know that you're necessarily a mediator, but do you sometimes feel like you become that when you work with families who try to make these tough decisions?
Yeah, psychologist, mediator, I don't know what you want to call it. Somebody that gets yelled at as a product of that. No. Those are really common scenarios that play out. For example, that Haraldson property that's going to be selling this Thursday, that's four brothers that live all over the nation, all up in years in terms of, they all have kids or don't have kids, have chosen not to have kids. But, transitioning that property can be difficult. And when you own property undivided with your siblings and three want to sell and two don't, like the circumstance that you brought up, Bridget, it becomes really difficult. You either have to get consensus, and a lot of times we're involved in that get consensus conversation. Maybe one or two of the three reach out to us and say, hey, brothers and sister, don't want to sell. We'd like to sit down with you. Maybe you can talk them into it. And of course, we talk them through the auction process, but talk about market conditions and the advantages to having an auction sale. But inevitably, you got to have some consensus and some agreement from those other siblings. Otherwise, you're screwed. You really are pooched. You can talk about partition actions and getting attorneys involved. And that's the next step if you are in that environment. But nobody wins in that environment. Life's too short. And, either keep it or try to get consensus or agree to disagree and split the proceeds.
I understand your position. I often have found myself being an agronomic therapist as well. I think you're in the same boat, Max.
Yep, something like that. Brad, who does the, he'll be on towards the tail end of the month. He's been an auctioneer for 42 years, and he's got a picture in his office that says Brad Olstead, auctioneer/therapist, or something like that. So call us what you want to, I guess.
You know, we've talked about land prices and auctions that are up and coming. Have you noticed that as you listen to reports that land prices have sort of plateaued and that we're seeing an asset leak where there's less available cash on the farm, but have you noticed much of that in the auction business, or are you continuing to see strong auction prices in the region and folks are still looking to make a strong investment, especially from the farmer's perspective?
So region-wide in the areas that we operate, so, you know, south to Missouri, all the way up to the Canadian border, what I would say is this land market has firmed up a bit this spring, with the caveat that it is still very spotty. So, you know, we'll do an auction sale, and we've been doing a lot of land auctions lately where, you know, geez, we'll have the auction, and that ain't so bad. That's near or at the highs. And then the next auction that we have, you know, disappoints us a little bit and shows us that the market has changed a little bit year over year. But in general, given the circumstances that farmers are in, you know, working capital is way down in terms of available cash to make a purchase. But the market, you know, relative to that is for farm real estate is still really good. And, you know, farmers are still in, a lot of them are still really in a good borrowing position if they want to choose to borrow money. There's still plenty of banks out there that are eager to lend these farmers a capital to make that purchase. So when you get a nice piece of land that comes up for sale, there's a lot of people still willing to stick their necks out there, despite this economy and this farm outlook being very poor from a 2025 perspective.
When you mentioned the best thing about, you know, a nice piece of land coming up for auction, and the first thing I thought of was your sale later this week on Thursday, where you're selling some land at Plum, I believe, Plum, Minnesota, and then next week at Barnesville, two really nice tracts of land. And if folks are interested in putting in some bids and wanting to look at those pieces, Max, where should they go? So a little bit about your website, and how can others sign up as bidders?
Sure. So we make it really easy. All you got to do is go to stephisgroup.com. If you don't already have an account with us, you can create one. And that's very easy to do. Name, address, and telephone number. From there, you'll have to go ahead and download the buyer's prospectus, which is the due diligence package that we put together on all of our properties that we sell. And that's got everything from soil information to FSA maps. You can take a look at that. And of course, we always encourage people to do their own due diligence from a perspective of jump in the truck and go look at it. All of our farms that we sell at auction have signs on them, and we encourage interested bidders to go out and take a look, whether it's that land at Flom or the Hovland land that's selling at Barnesville. Great opportunities to go take a drive with this nice weather that we have right now anyway. We'll see if that changes.
All right. Well, I appreciate that very much, Max, and especially the fact that you put so many details on your website when it comes to the land. Not only where is it located, but you talk about productivity ratings and tiling and improvements that have been made, and even sometimes those little things that matter, like there's a bin on one of those tracks. So thank you for doing that for us. I appreciate it.
Yep. Devil's always in the details, and we want informed bidders, because informed bidders are typically confident bidders. You know, bidders that waffle or might not make that last bid, or bidders that are unsure of something. So we really try to do a good job at presenting all the facts, whether it's a combine or a tillable piece of farm acreage. We want all the information at the bidder's fingertips, and that's what we strive to do every day.
Thank you, Max. And that is Max Steffes. He is with Steffes Group. And we hear from Steffes Group twice a month on the Auction Block is this segment. So stay tuned when we come back. We have a guest joining us. We're going to talk all about raising Vidalia onions in Georgia. We're going to do that with Cliff Reiner. He is with the Schumann Farms in Georgia. Be right back. Thanks for being here on Weather and Ag in Focus on this sunshiny, lot less windy day than we had yesterday. And that's all going to change by the end of the week. With those cold temperatures and a blizzard coming, this is a great opportunity for you to join all of us in celebrating the National Agriculture Week, which will start next week, Monday, on St. Patrick's Day. We are giving away a quilt. It's called the Farmer's Prayer. It is a 5-foot by 7-foot handmade quilt, features the Farmer's Prayer on it. And there's a picture of it on our live stream. If you are watching us on Facebook, YouTube, or Acres TV under WDAY, Weather and Ag in Focus, you'll see a picture of that quilt. How can you win it? You can nominate someone. Please go to our website. You can reach us on our WDAY 970 AM website, and you will see a click the button spot where it's talking about National Ag Week, and you can put in a nomination for who you think is a great farmer and deserves this Farmer's Prayer quilt. We'll be drawing for that next Friday on March 21st. Well, great farmers are all around the region and the country, and we're joined by one of them today, Cliff Reiner, and I hope I'm saying Reiner right. Cliff is with Schumann Farms out of Georgia. And Cliff, you kind of got roped into this last minute. I should probably apologize to you for that.
That's no problem. You've got the Reiner right, and I'm used to getting roped into stuff at the last minute. But actually, I work for GNR Farms, so Stephen Schumann is the guy that you roped me into it, and he works for GNR, but there is a Schumann Farms, and they're across the fence row. They're, you know, that's the one unique thing about the Vidalia production region is we're all neighbors, basically. You know, we're in a geographically confined area, and they're, you know, very good neighbor and competitor. My mother taught all the Schumann clan, but we're working with GNR Farms here in southeast Georgia, but all of us are right here on top of one another, so it's an easy mistake to make.
Well, you know why this might be a little fuzzy is the reason I met Stephen Schumann was at tailgating when Mercer came to North Dakota to play in the playoffs, and he and his family kind of showed up in our tailgate spot, and now we're going to talk about onions with you, Cliff.
That's right.
All right. Go ahead, Dean. Yeah, we've got a lot of questions.
Yeah, I do. So, Cliff, I mean, how does Vidalia onions, how does that compare, for people that don't know, why is that so much better onion in many people's eyes? What makes it stand out?
Well, I think the way to best understand that is what the different types of onions that most people are used to seeing in a storefront or store shelf. And, you know, our sweet onion is the Vidalia sweet onion, and that is considered a yellow Granax onion. So obviously we've got yellow onions, white onions, red onions, and the sweet onion or the yellow Granax onion are short day grown onions, which means they're growing during the winter time or the shortest days of the year. And actually right now we're, you know, experiencing spring green up. The spring equinox is in another week and a half, let's just say. And that's triggering our bulbs to mature. Whereas onions that are grown in like New York State or Wisconsin or Idaho or Oregon are considered long day onions. And long day onions are typically grown in the summer, grown in the longer days of the year, and they mature in the fall. And those typically are hotter. They typically are machine harvested. And they can be machine harvested because they're a little bit hotter and have a few more solids, we call it, in there. But they're a darker husk. It's not something you want to eat raw. Vidalia onion is a sweet onion, and it's mild enough that if I cut it, I generally don't tear up. You can tear up, but even if so, you can eat it, you know, raw without being diced or caramelized on like a hamburger or a hot dog. That was kind of our claim to fame, is it's mild enough to eat raw.
Carl, you're not only an agronomist here, but I think you're also a chef from what I just heard you describing.
Well, I mean, it's a big part of our deal is, you know, my background, you know, I used to work with the University of Georgia in cooperative extension, and we did a lot of research on Vidalia onion because it's an important part of our location and our geography and our ag climate. And flavor is where we get our name to fame. And so we have to understand the dynamics of what this we do to the soil and the varieties we select influence the flavor that the consumer tastes. And that's one unique thing that we like about growing this crop is we can really impact that culinary experience with stuff we do on the farm. And you can take pride in that is that you can have bragging rights of who can grow the sweeter onion or, you know, try to get somebody, your neighbor in a kind of a argument who grows the, not only biggest, but the sweetest onions. So.
Okay. When you said that about soil and your impacts on it, is there a better soil type for raising the onions versus a different one? I mean, I'm living in an area where we have a heavy Fargo clay. As you move off that glacial lake bottom, you leave the heavy clay, we get more of a silty loam. What do you see in your soil types where you're at, Cliff?
Okay, so the biggest factor, and most of our soils in Southeast Georgia are considered a sandy loam. Some are more of a deep sand than others, but they're typically a sandy soil. And so the sand, the sulfur compounds are really where the hot and distasteful flavor kicks in with the onion eating experience. Nitrogen can play somewhat of a role to that as well. But, you know, sulfur leaches out of sand and nitrogen leaches out of sand. But we also need some of both of those to make a crop. So there's a balancing act, and there's a kind of more of an art form. And we use scientific approaches like tissue sampling and soil sampling and history and that sort of thing. Mapping of fields with soil and tissue sampling to kind of refine that artwork. But at the end of the day, the sandier the soil, the better the flavor is. And that's kind of worked out. We've studied a lot of that, and there's a lot of history behind that. And so it's unique for us as a geography-wise, this part of the state is, if you go back in the 1980s when the Vidalia onion really took off, it allowed the kind of the non-productive soil for anything else. You couldn't grow corn or peanuts or cotton on this type of soil. And we could have a cash crop, and a lot of people put irrigation on their sorriest soil because it meant better Vidalia onions, and that was their, you know, cash crop at the time. So we're kind of unique in that standpoint that, you know, there's probably more fertile soil that's non-irrigated in pockets around us. And, you know, but the higher value soil to me is really the sandier soil.
Oh, Cliff, you are such a wealth of knowledge. Okay, for those who are listening and you want to ask questions like I do, you can reach us on our phone line of 701-293-9000. That's the JLA insurance phone line. When we return from our bottom of the hour news, I want to know about weather conditions, how you plant, how you harvest, how you store them, and then so much more of those details. We'll continue our conversation with Cliff Reiner after we return. Thanks for joining this discussion today, because if you weren't thinking about what you were going to make for supper tonight, you will be now, and you're probably going to include onions into whatever it is that you're making. We are joined by our guest today, who is Cliff Reiner. He is with GNR Farms in Georgia. We're talking about raising onions. So as a kid who's never seen onions except the ones in my garden, Cliff, how do you plant them? Are they little bulbs, or do you start them as seed? Because you said that those sweet onions are a short day. So I'm real curious what's going on with them.
Okay. So we buy seed. We don't grow our own seed here, mainly because any onion seed is grown in a real arid climate. Short day onion seed have to be grown in a short day area that's arid. Long day onion seed have to be grown in a long day area that's very arid and very dry. So we buy the seed from certain seed companies. There are several, you know, big, small, and different. There's all type of sizes. And those genetics and those varieties have been, you know, trialed in our area. It's not something that we do lightly. We really particular what varieties we purchase. So once we purchase that seed, we call that unit of seed 100,000 seed. And the seed's about the size of an okra seed. It's very small, a little bit bigger than a mustard. And we will plant those in a high-density seed bed. That high-density seed bed will hold about 20 to 25 units, or 20 to 2,500,000 lots or units of seed in an acre. And typically, you know, we can get, you know, things like Hurricane Helene was damaging to us this past year. We can get damage, but typically a unit of seed will translate into about 1 acre of transplanted in the field by the time we lose 8 or 10 or 12%. And we adjust our population, our transplant population, accordingly. But basically, once we put that small seed in the ground, we're only planting it about a half inch deep or shallower. And we have to be really intense and grow those seedlings in about 7 to 8 weeks, and we will harvest those seedlings. and then transplant them by hand. We harvest them by hand. We basically manage the tops with a mower to get them all the same length and pull them up in a bundles of 100 plants, and then put a rubber band around them and then carry them to a different field. And that field has been, you know, prepped. We deep till the land. We'll make beds with a rotavator typically. And after that, there's a transplanting wheel that goes by and indents the holes where the onions will go in rows. And so like currently our population is about 99,000 plants per acre. So every one of those 99,000 plants per acre is planted by hand. There's not, looked at other ways. There's not a good another way. And it really boils down to the way we grow transplants. Now, in other production regions like South Texas, Idaho, and other onion production regions, they can direct seed onions, which means if I'm placing the transplant about 4 inches apart in the drill, where I'm growing a high density seed beds, I'm like a centimeter apart. And that correlates into whenever they're direct seeding, they're basically planting that seed every 4 inches apart. And they've got good enough weather system to allow it to come up and stay in place. They don't have to move that plant ever again. So they're at a competitive advantage from a cost managing that. But we can't do that is primarily weed control. We overwinter, but they still live during the winter. So with a transplant, I'm actually transplanting it about 2 inches deep. So the basal plate of the onion, the meristematic tissue, to be scientific, where the growing point, that embryonic development of that plant is in the root plate. So if I can put it at 2 inches deep, most of our winters, not all, but most of our winters, it's got enough insulation to survive a deep freeze. But a direct seeded onion, I'm only a half inch deep. And so the insulation is not there and it's more susceptible to cold injury. So we dabble less than 3 to 5% of our crop every year is dabbled with direct seeded. And we're always at risk. We're figuring out some things we can do with the weed control. It's still not perfect. There's still technologies that's helping that. But even if the technology was available with the laser weeders or stuff like that, we are still at a risk standpoint of having a complete crop failure if there's a severe enough cold to freeze that root plate out. So that's why we transplant primarily. And so after that, it's really like we get them planted, we want to get them planted in between 90% of our acres is planted between Thanksgiving and Christmas. We'll start about the first part of November and we want to get them rooted in. Again, if you're thinking about day length, the shortest day of the year is right there before Christmas at the winter solstice. So we want to get them established and starting to cut root. They're not a plug grown transplant. So all those roots that grew for those 8 weeks in the seed beds have to start over. So you have to have a big enough plant about the size of a pencil or your pinky. That's where your energy is stored to allow that to have energy to cut root. And then it'll put on a leaf and then another leaf over time to gather energy. And then it's a slow growing process. And then we really see a rapid uptake in growth. Of the top in like mid February through the month of March. And so really, I always say the month of March, every week they'll double in size. So the first of March versus the 30th of March, there'll be 4 times difference. And that's literally pretty much the case. We we're doing a lot of things before that time to make sure when that period occurs that we're ready, that we've done our fertilizer. We've got everything we need there for that plant to do. You have all it needs when the weather is going to dictate it to grow. And then we harvest in April and May.
Gotcha. And Cliff, we've got Tom on line one. He's got a question for you. Tom, go ahead. What's your question for Cliff?
Yeah, so I'm wondering, so the Vidalia would be mostly an eating onion. I mean, burgers and salads and that kind of stuff. And so are the white ones used in processing? You have onion flakes, onion powder. Is this where we see the majority of the onion and that type, or onion rings in restaurants. Are the white onions used more for that versus the Vidalia?
So typically the white and the yellow onion, is there's not much separating the two. So there is a yellow sweet, and there's a yellow, some people call it a yellow storage or a yellow cooking onion. And in even that subcategory, there's what they call dehydrators. And the dehydrators are probably more for like the powders, the process, the powders after it's, you know, the processed in that form. But there's a little bit of a variation. I'll give you an example. We have a contract with a vendor that buys our like non-premium retail grade. They may have a, like a nick on the outside. We call them a number two grade onion. They still have to be of good quality, just not aesthetically pleasing. And those go to process and to have like diced onions to sell to like pizzas, like Domino's or McDonald's or whatever. So there's a little bit of both. The white onions, and a lot of that is regional. I know the Hispanic population typically likes whiter onions. They're really in demand in Mexico. They're really in demand in pockets of the U.S. that has a higher Hispanic population. But there are certain recipes that probably do lend more to a hotter onion, like a yellow or a white cooking onion. But the sweet onion is also used in cooking. And that's one thing we've been fortunate and blessed with, is a lot of chefs out there will distinctly tell the difference. And we try to promote that in the education piece through like the Vidalia Onion Committee, which is our kind of our grower, you know, collective. It's part of our USDA marketing order that protects us, but they are also charged with promotion and marketing as well.
Huh. Now, Cliff, I've got a question about, in terms of weather, when you're first planting, I mean, those seeds are so small, and with it being planted so shallow, what do you do if you get a heavy rainstorm? Are you losing a whole crop?
It's part of the deal. I mean, it's part of the risk involved. You know, and we have, that's what's crazy about it is when you think about it, this year was really like, everybody knows it, but when you live it, it goes in a different gulp. You have to swallow that pill.
Oof.
You know, like we have crop insurance once this time of the year, the crop's getting in the ground. We have a crop insurance, say if there was a hailstorm or whatever, that we could kind of get our money back. But we don't have crop insurance for seed beds. That's not a crop. It's not a protected thing. Right. And really per acre, it's like 20 times the cost. Like we have $8,000 to $10,000 per acre in that 8 week period, just wow, to grow those seed beds. And it's really intense. So what we try to do to answer your question is pick soils that are forgiving for packing rains, pick soils that will drain. So they may have a little bit of a crest of a hill that they're not sitting in water if you have a heavy rain, but you don't want too much of a slope where they'll create a wash. So it's really picky. And like Hurricane Helene came through here. And so we have of that seed bed, that 8 week period of time, we'll have about three to four, anywhere from 4 days to a week apart, to try to because we can't plant them all in a couple of days. We need them to stay fresh and not get too big to make the transplants the right size for our labor. So with that being said, you know, our first sowing was what really was up. They were about an inch and a half tall when Hurricane Helene came through, and it pretty much wiped them out. We had, for instance, in our first sowing, we had enough seed planted to do about 220 to 230 acres every year. And we got 64 acres off of that after the storm. And so that's a big loss. And that was consistent across all of our neighbors. And, you know, fortunately, we had it, that being on the earlier side, the stuff that the second and the third sowing was not up, so it didn't like get blew down or anything. So those were kind of normal and okay. And we did replant some of that variety loss, but then there is such a thing as the maturity that we kind of suffered from. But then you don't get any of that seed money back. So it's just more seed money going into a later planting date. Mm. And what we did do though, is we had to delay that replant even later because we were without power for like 16 days at my house, and I think the pivot where we were going to plant them was like 9 days before the pivot system would work for you to irrigate. So one of our neighbors rented a generator, and me and him and another guy rotated it around just to keep the crop that was there still healthy and watered, because it's still hot here during that time of the year. And so once the power come on, or, you know, when we plant, we have to irrigate them every day because it is hot and they're only a half inch deep and it is sandy soil. So you're not putting a lot of water out, but you've got to do it to rehydrate that seed when it soaks up its first bit of moisture and cool the soil down and get uniform emergence. So there's a really intense procedure, but heavy rains and weather do play a role in our cropping system. And it's really, you know, been evident this year with a hurricane. And then we had it's pretty rare for us to have snow that sticks, especially. We did have a snowstorm and had about 5 or 6 inches across the region in January. That's, you know, we're okay, but you can't say that it didn't impact you.
Oh, absolutely. So one question in here while we're talking, Cliff, weed control, are you doing all mechanical? Is there anything that you can do when it comes to a herbicide, or what does that look like for you when you're raising onions?
So that's one thing on the transplant system. We're okay. We have two products that we use in conjunction is Gol, which is oxifluorophen as the active ingredient, and a generic type of Prowl, which is pendimethalin. And those two mixed together right after transplanting generally gives us pretty good control, season-long control. There are some instances where fields have been out of a bad rotation and they may can get a few breakthroughs, and that's typically either hand hoed or plowed of some kind at some point in the season. And so that's the weed control is typically not that bad. On a direct seeded, though, it is a completely different system. We can only apply those same herbicides until later in the plant. So in other words, we have nothing when we seed on a direct seeded. So for a season long direct seeded, that's another major issue. There are some people looking at these laser weeders and all like that, but from a transplant system, as long as we can continue to get labor, that's probably not our limiting factor in terms of success.
Cliff, you have given us so much great information. This has been just fun to listen to about onion production, things we never expected.
We could keep him on the show for another half hour easily.
Yeah.
Half hour. Well,
anytime he's coming want to come back down or visit again, just let us know.
So yeah. We've
like
only
have
got y'all a
live on location
left.
In a couple of weeks.
That'd be nice.
Oh, that'd be fabulous.
Right?
So we've only got maybe about another minute left. And one last question I wanted to ask was fertilizer. Do you have are you doing granular fertilizer, liquid? Do you have a regular setup for that? Like I said, I've only got about a minute to ask that question, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so really we use granular still pretty much as an industry. The liquid may work, but we're not using drip irrigation, and that would be the primary delivery method if we wanted to use liquid, would be through drip. So it's granular for right now, and it works pretty good. It offers a little challenge, but we're used to it.
Oh, man. I can't say thank you enough, because I think we're going to have lots more questions, Cliff. So I'm keeping your name and number. You just never know when I need an onion expert. And
let us
know
anytime I need to jump back on. We'll be glad to tell what we're passionate about doing.
That's awesome.
Oh, and you are. And so, again, that's Cliff Reiner. He is with GNR Farms in Georgia, and he has been a stellar guest for us. We've got just a couple minutes here. Dean, do you want to give us a little heads up before the weekend on our weather?
Yeah, sure. And we're looking at temperatures. We're almost 40 degrees colder today than we were yesterday when we had record highs in the mid-60s. And today, right now, we're in the mid-20s, making it up to about 30 or so. And then as we head into tonight, back down into the 20s, maybe a snow shower or two from evening hours onward. And that's mainly north of the 94 corridor. And then tomorrow, we'll start our warm-up up to 50 degrees, and then low 60s on Thursday, but the winds pick up as well. And then we're keeping an eye on that big storm system, which is part of it is just starting to pull on shore in the Pacific. That is going to give us rain and a few thunderstorms as we head into Friday night. That's going to change over to snow, and parts of the area are likely to have blizzard conditions as we head into Saturday. So if you have any travel plans on Saturday, keep up to date on the forecast. We're going from 60s on Friday to near blizzard conditions across parts of the area on Saturday. So a wide swing in weather coming our way.
I don't know if that's a big surprise, but like I said, we can make sure to nominate farmers that if you have the cold spell setting in on you, you can go to our website, nominate them for the farmer prayer quilt that we've got. And again, you can find it on the WDA website where you can click the button, put in your nomination. We had a question yesterday if it would be just for folks in North Dakota, but it's not. We can have anybody nominate from any state. That's just fine. And we're going to give that quilt away during this show, Weather and Ag in Focus, next Friday, March 21st. So that's just one thing we got to make sure to put on our radar.
Does that have to be a local farmer, Bridget?
Nope, can be anyone.
So we can nominate Cliff.
Or listening.
We could have Cliff nominate.
We could.
All right.
We could nominate Cliff. Oh, yes. Okay, and let's not also forget that next week, National Ag Week, National Ag Day, is going to be on Tuesday, March 18th. Keep an eye out for us. We're going to be celebrating that in various ways around town. You just never know when you'll see a WDAY radio crew out there asking you questions to help celebrate National Ag Week. We're really looking forward to it.
Perfect. It's going to be a busy week next week. And again, keep up to date on the forecast throughout the week. We'll be updating you on air and online. But again, we should have a better track handle on the track of the storm as we head into tomorrow as that system comes on shore. But be prepared to alter your plans if you have anything going on Saturday. So for Bridget, myself, I want to thank everybody for joining us. The Jay Thomas Show coming up next.